You're watching The Sports Objective, the podcast for Pirates.
Welcome into episode number 3 of The Coach's Kid here on the Sports Objective Network. I'm Kyle Barber, and I'm joined tonight pinch hitting for Bubba Rosenbaum is Stevie Fly. How you doing, Stevie?
Doing good, bud. Doing good. How about you?
I'm doing all right. Tonight, as we continue talking to the sons and daughters of head coaches from the collegiate world and the professional world, we're going to talk to a guy here, Ted Pardee. We've had Ted on the show. Ted's color analyst for the Houston Cougars. We've had Ted on the show in the past previewing when East Carolina on our regular Sports Objective podcast has played the Houston Cougars. But tonight we're going to talk about Ted's father, Jack Pardee, who, you know, I mentioned that we talked to the children of coaches from professional and collegiate ranks. And with Jack, Ted, he did it all, man. I'll start it off like this: the only man to ever coach in the World Football League, the USFL, the Canadian Football League, Division One, and the NFL,
and be named Coach of the Year in each of those leagues. That's the big deal.
Oh wow, I didn't even realize that. That was not in my notes here. That's even more amazing.
And that's something that will never happen again. So, I mean,
I don't think so.
He's one of a kind there.
Well, some of those leagues don't exist anymore.
WFL doesn't even exist.
No more WFL.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, the USFL exists to me in name only. It's not what it used to be, obviously. So, Ted, we'll start off, obviously, with the basics here. Just like everybody else, you were born. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about you as a child and where you were born and where your dad was in his career when you joined his life.
So great question, Kyle. So, you know, I'm actually out in Southern California right now. I was born here. My dad played, he was drafted in the second round of the NFC or of the NFL draft in 1957, he was the 12th pick in the draft. So, you know, kind of shows you how much smaller the NFL was back then. But dad went from playing for Bear Bryant in Texas A&M, finished up his 1957 season with one loss. As crazy as this sounds, they were on probation by the NCAA, if you can imagine that. And even back then, they did that crazy stuff. And so that they had limited game coverage and bowl, all that kind of stuff. So, but his college experience was unbelievable, being one of Bear Bryant's team members, the Junction Boys. So my dad's sophomore year in college, Bear was named the head coach, and he took all the team, loaded them up in buses, and took them out to West Texas, to a little town called Junction, and basically ran them in the dirt for 3 weeks. And every night he basically said, come get your bus ticket. You can leave anytime you want. I'd say it's kind of a similar thing to what Deion Sanders, what Coach Prime did up at Colorado. The concept was the same. Bear was trying to turn over the roster, and he did that. They only had 35 guys out of 120 that went out to Junction. They only had 37 guys that came back with the team, and that's who they started their 54 season with. So my dad was one of those guys, went through the most grueling training camp. There's a movie that they made about it, a great book that's been written if you're interested. But that was my dad. We get to California, and I'm the youngest of five kids. I was born here in Los Angeles, and my family, we moved around a lot. You know, if you're a coach's kid, you're gonna move around a lot. And but we moved 13 times before I got to high school.
Wow.
Which, with stops in, you mentioned the Florida Blazers and the World Football League. That was my dad's first head coaching job after being the linebackers coach for 1 year with the Redskins in 73. And then the year prior to that, 1972, was my dad's last season as a player, his 16th year playing linebacker. And they finished up the season with the sort of the historic Super Bowl loss to the undefeated Miami Dolphins. That was his last game that he played in. But, yeah, you know, Florida Blazers, got my dad was then named head coach of Chicago Bears. He was the first non-Bear, so non-Chicago Bear former coach or player to be named head coach of the Bears, which was a rare extinction.
Now, how old were you when he became the head coach at, of the Chicago Bears?
Well, I believe he was 38 or 39, and I was in first grade. So first, second, and third grade I spent in Chicago as a kid.
What kind of memories do you have of that? I mean, you were a very small elementary school.
Yeah.
Do you remember that well? Or I mean, your dad wanted Chicago. So.
Yeah, well, he turned it around. You know, they hadn't been to the playoffs in something like 16 years. And, you know, they just had been on a bad run in Chicago. And you know, my dad, he took a chance on a guy who was at HBCU. He was a guy that nobody was paying attention to, but the guy changed football. His name was Walter Payton.
Oh, yeah.
And back in those days, you didn't draft anybody unless they were from usually a big-time school. And it was rare for the historically black college players to really get a shot in the NFL. But he was so electric. I remember talking to my dad about that, saying, how did you convince, you know, the old guard of the Bears – to go outside of the bubble and go draft him? And he said, you know, Ted, it was my first head coaching job, and that was going to be my very first pick as a head coach in the NFL. He goes, I bet my career on, I knew just looking at Walter, he was going to be hard to tackle. And he said, if I couldn't tackle him, then I wanted him. And that was his deal. So he brings in Walter, brings in a bunch of other guys. You know, in our world today, you would never do this, but he gave the ball to Walter, you know, 40, 30, you know, high 30s, 40, 45 times a day, a game. But he did it because that was his horse. Walter was tough. Man, was he tough. A tough runner, a hard runner, incredibly talented, as we all know. But so I was the kid walking around the locker room after the game and going over to their facility, which is in Lake Forest, Illinois. And, you know, as a little kid, other kids went to summer camp or did different things. I was always at training camp. My whole life growing up, I would go to the Bears camp, Redskins camp, you know, San Diego Chargers, every place my dad coached, I was always a ball boy. Walter just had there's something about him that, you know, he'd pick me up, throw me over his shoulders or carry me around on his shoulders. Just incredible guy. We remained incredibly close to him through his death. And he was so kind to my family for so many years. My dad left the Bears to go home to the Redskins where he had played. And when we played the Bears the first year in 1978, they played at RFK Stadium in DC. After the game, Walter came over to the Redskins locker room just to say hello to my dad you know, kind of uncharacter. NFL was different back then. The NFL was a different kind of deal. So, but yeah, lots of experiences like that, lots of fun experiences like that growing up.
Well, one of the things that just looking at your dad's past, I'm a volunteer coach. We at a small private school, we play 8-man football. Your dad played 6-man football, one of the few to make it in the NFL as a 6-man football player. And I find that fascinating because there's so few. I think I can think of, count your dad, I can think of like 3 that I know off the top of my head that had NFL careers there. And I just love the fact that playing 6-man, I can't imagine 6. It's hard enough, you know, with 8 because it's wide open. And 6 has got to be really wide open. And I mean, that probably helped your dad later on, knowing how explosive the offenses could be when he gets to Houston.
Well, you know, it's funny. You probably know, 6-man football, everybody's eligible, including the center, right? Yeah. So it's wide open, and you know, dad, Back then, another thing that a lot of people forget, there's been so many rule changes in football. Back when my dad played college ball, it was platoon football, which meant when you get on the field, you could not be substituted off, even with a change of down. So you played both ways the whole game. And the second you got substituted, you were out for the half. So if you were in the third quarter and you got hurt and you got substituted, you were done for the game. So you didn't come off the field. That was the deal back when my dad played.
Wow.
So six-man football kind of prepared him for that. Yeah. And, you know, you look at my dad's offenses that he had. He always tried to build around the talent, right? So when you get Walter Payton, you run the ball, right? You know, you run the ball. You go to Washington, D.C., you got John Riggins, you run the ball, right? He went out to San Diego to coach defense as defensive coordinator and got to see how Don Coryell ran things with Dan Fouts you know, John Jefferson and Wes Chandler. So they slung the ball around, and I'll never forget my dad telling me, he goes, yeah, I got off the field or I walked out into the locker room and Dan Fouts comes up to me. He goes, I don't care what you have to do. I don't care if they score on your DBs. Let's put pressure on that quarterback and get me the ball back as fast as you can. And my dad said, well, that kind of changed his mentality a little bit on all of football. He was a ball control guy early on, and that experience made him think, you know what? Maybe there is something to this four wide receiver stuff. And that's how the run and shoot got to the Houston Gamblers. Was my dad's next job was the Houston Gamblers. And he got Jim Kelly at quarterback. Man, he had so many great receivers. Herschel Walker. Well, that was when they merged the team with, you know, when Donald Trump bought the team and then moved everybody up to New York and merged them with the New Jersey Generals. And they became the Generals. And that team, you know, that was the greatest team that never played a game. And it had so many NFL stars on that team. And you know, the antitrust suit that the USFL won, but they were only awarded $1. And it was, you know, it was the award was trebled. So they got $3 and that was the end of the USFL. But man, it was great to grow up in high school, seeing the run and shoot, getting to know Doug. Doug Flutie was on that team as well. Yeah. So getting to know all those guys, they were just the greatest guys on the planet. Jim Kelly is one of the greatest guys, nicest guy on the planet. You know, I was in college at the time when he was moving to the Bills, and he still had his home in Houston. And I'll never forget being out at a bar one night in the off season with all my college teammates, and Jim was at the other end of the bar, and he sent us a tray of tequila shots one night. That's who Jim Kelly was. Just the greatest guy on the planet. Like the guy you want to go have a beer with right now. That was Jim Kelly. So
I can see that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But you know, and then the run and shoot, you know, the Gamblers really ushered it in, and then the University of Houston, they made it happen. And you know, I played with Andre Ware, you know, just one of the, again, a great guy, like just a buddy. You know, Dre is, I think he's a great announcer. He's still with ESPN. He works and he does the NFL games too. But Andre Ware was a great quarterback, and you know, he did some amazing stuff. That was for sure.
Ted, we backtrack a little bit here. I wanted to talk about your dad's stint with the Redskins.
Yeah,
and I kind of want to go because to kind of get inside your head a little bit. Your dad got fired with the Redskins in third season. Was it 1980, 1981?
It was 1980.
1980. How old were you when your dad was fired?
So I remember it by grades. That's because I remember what school I went to. You know, you got to kind of keep track of it. I went to three different schools for third grade, and I went to two schools for sixth grade.
Probably middle school.
Yeah, so it was sixth grade. I started sixth grade in Washington, and then we lived in Virginia, out in Middleburg. So we kind of lived on a farm, actually, just kind of get out a real respite for my dad working there. So when my dad originally took the job with the Redskins, it was kind of his dream job because he had played there. My mom loved the Appalachian Mountains. She just loved, you know, everything about it. So when he had that opportunity to take that job, when his mentor, George Allen, was fired, you know, it was kind of a dream come true. He went back and ended up coaching a bunch of his old teammates. That was a really interesting thing. Yeah. You know, Chris Hamburger. Chris was, you know, Chris was my dad's buddy, and now my dad was his coach. You know, and my dad hired Richie Pettibone to be the defense coordinator. Richie had been their free safety for a while. You know, so it was a very familiar, very family feeling. The owner of the team at the time was Edward Bennett Williams, who was a famous attorney and did a lot of great legal work. Has a massive international law firm in D.C. called that's got his name on it. Anyway, Edward Bennett Williams was a great friend of my dad's, a wonderful friend. Well, he also had ownership in the Orioles. And so at the same time, there was a minority owner, Jack Kent Cook. And Jack Kent Cook was told by the NFL, you can only, if you're going to own an NFL team, you cannot own any other NBA team or NHL teams or anything like that. They had a rule for probably two decades. It was like that. So at the time, Jack Kent Cook owned the LA Lakers. He owned the LA Kings, and he sold them both to focus on the Redskins. And when he came to Washington, you know, we had a really, it was a weird kind of change of power from Edward Bennett Williams, the owner, and he ended up going off to the Orioles and owned the Orioles full stop. So when Jack Kent Cook came in, he had a little bit of a different vibe to him, and he rubbed a couple of the players the wrong way. So in 1979, John Riggins held out the whole season. He didn't play just because Jack Kent Cook wouldn't pay him what he thought he was, you know, what he would deserve. And, you know, John Riggins, Riggo was he's a crazy man. Like you didn't want to try to play against him. He was the toughest guy out there, and he'd run you over. But you know, I think he was stubborn. And he wasn't going to let some, you know, nerdy millionaire at the time tell him what to do, right? And if he wasn't going to get paid, he wasn't going to play. And as much as my dad tried to talk him into playing, it wasn't going to happen. So that happened. And then Joe Theismann got hurt, and Theismann was out for the season. So you got your two best, most important players both out for the season. We finished that year. The Redskins finished, I believe it was 6-10 that year. Yeah. Did not make the playoffs. After going 10-6 the year before and didn't make the playoffs, but it was the 10-win season because of the way the chips fell with the Cowboys. So you can't do that in Washington. You can't miss the playoffs 2 years in a row.
Yeah. And back then you could. Now it seems like it happens a lot. Yeah.
Well, nowadays these coaches get these crazy long contracts and they're making money. Like,
tell me about it.
My dad got paid. I think he was paid $165,000 a year as the head coach of the Redskins.
Wow.
He was paid $45,000 a year as the head coach of the Chicago Bears.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't even work with inflation calculator to what he does to make now. No, really. I mean, really.
Yeah, you're right.
So just not to get on the negative, but I always like to ask this. When your dad was fired or when he took any criticism, you know, at the end of time, Washington, you know, they lost to the Cowboys, missed the playoffs, and that's when he got fired.
Yeah.
How was it for you in school? Were you kind of isolated from that?
Not at all. You can't. You know, D.C., all you got to do is Google 1979 Redskins, and the Washington Times will come up, and you've got, you know, President Carter on part of the page and my dad on the other part. Like, the newspaper used to be everything, and it's such a hot focus of – it used to be. I don't know. Maybe not now, but I'll tell you, it was hot focus on the Redskins. And to make matters even crazier, I went to school with Jack Kent Cook's grandkids.
Oh, wow.
And so it was awkward. I mean, it was really awkward. His grandsons, they held him out of school for the next 2 weeks. Like, they kept him out of school just because they didn't want those kids getting picked. They were, you know, because my dad was popular and you know, he didn't win. So that rubbed everybody the wrong way. But he was kind of somebody they loved. And the other thing was that the way that Cook handled it was really odd, because everyone joked that it was the Inquisition. So at the end of the year, he had a series of meetings for 2 weeks where Bobby Bethard, who had been a scout in Miami when my dad got the job, and he was a hot scout. So my dad insisted that Edward Bennett Williams hire him as his general manager, the irony. And then he put my dad and Bobby against each other, pitted them against each other, and basically said, all right, I'm only going to keep one of you guys. You got two weeks to sell yourselves to me. And they covered it in the newspaper every day.
Wow.
Yeah. It was just wild. So, and you know, it's, you know, Bobby's kids and I were friends, and that's football, you know, and Cook ended up backstabbing Bobby in the end too, you know, and Bobby had to go out to San Diego to finish his career.
Yeah.
But you know, that's pro ball. It's super, super vicious and competitive. And I'll never forget, I was sitting at the kitchen table in December, you know, almost leading up to the new year, like 27th or 28th, somewhere in there. And dad came home and we all kind of just stopped and looked, and he goes, well, I guess I'm going to be a full-time farmer now. And that was it. So we lived on a cattle farm. My dad had cows out there, and sure enough, like 3 weeks later, San Diego Chargers said, hey, we want you to be our defensive coordinator. And we were moving to San Diego.
It must be a culture shock to you from Washington to San Diego. But before we get into moving from Washington to San Diego, I do want to ask you, you know, as we talked about, you know, you going to school with Cook's kids and, you know, all that. Kate Holland, Terry Holland's daughter, told a story last week when she was on here, when she was in sixth grade, ironically enough. She was going to school with a big booster son, a big booster at UVA, their son. And he started taunting her relentlessly for a couple of days that her dad was going to get fired. His dad was going to make sure that her dad got fired. And she ended up punching him in the face and busting his nose and getting suspended. Did you have any incidents like that?
Well, I did have something similar. I didn't get suspended. It was at that school, and it was, you know, kids will pick on the coach's kids. It's being a coach's kid, you know, you gotta just take the territory for what it is. And if you can imagine how vicious people are on Twitter and Instagram and everything, social media today, kids in school were that way to your face. The thing that was different for me was that I was getting bigger. So, I eventually played college football and played outside linebacker like my dad. I'm the exact same size my dad was when he played ball. So I'm built just like him. So by the time I got to high school, all of that stuff pretty much ended for me.
Right. Yeah.
Nobody was going to mess around with me in high school.
So hey, how was it? Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Kyle, we got a comment in here that might be a little interesting, Mr. Ted. Sure. As a guy, Johnny Robertson said his first job ever at 16 was at HBL Porsche Audi. He said, I was 16 when my first assignment at my first job was to deliver a gold Audi 5000 to your dad at Redskin Park. Said he was able to meet and enjoyed the short chat, and he was and still am friends with the Bethard family. So I thought you might find that kind of interesting there. Do you remember that car?
That's awesome. I do. So it was, you know, my dad was like the classic coach. We never owned a car. Like, we never owned a car until he got to the Gamblers. It was just because the
loaner cars. Yeah.
The team always got you a loaner. And so my dad had a deal with Johnny Coons, which is a big dealership up in, or Coons dealership, which is up in Virginia. And so we had two Ford Broncos. I mean, I'm the youngest of five kids. So I had three siblings all driving cars, and my mom had to have a car and my dad had a car. So I remember my mom drove that Audi 5000 actually. And it was a front wheel drive car. And I'll never forget, after a big snowstorm, she's driving me to my like dentist or something. And we slide off the road into a snowbank, but because it was front wheel drive, man, it just backed right. It, you know, just pulled right out of that snow and took back off again. It was pretty funny, but yeah, I remember that car.
That's interesting. You never know. Small world. Didn't think we'd, you know, Johnny's a regular listener to our regular programming. So, you mentioned it, just curious, you were living on a farm in Virginia.
Yeah.
You know, D.C. is a metropolitan area, but it sounded like you guys were living out in the country in Virginia, which really there is no more country in Northern Virginia now.
right.
So was it a culture? You had lived in Chicago in elementary school. Was it a culture shock to you moving from Virginia to San Diego, or had you moved around so much it was just the next place to go?
I think for us it was kind of the next place to go. It was sad leaving Washington because, you know, living on a 52-acre cattle ranch outside of D.C., I mean, it was like I said, a dream come true for our family. And we moved from there to San Diego, which, it's expensive in Southern California. So we lived in a little rental house in La Jolla, which is a beautiful area. And I made so many great friends in Southern California as well. There was a little bit of culture shock, but part of what I've had to do my whole career and my life is assimilate, right? You got to get into a new role. Yep. You got to kind of endear yourself to the folks that you're with and try to get acceptance from the kids you go to school with. So I went from living in Northern Virginia to living in San Diego, going to the beach, learning how to surf, trying to make sure I didn't get too many sunburns.
Did you prefer San Diego? Sounds like it would have been a lot of fun high school age.
San Diego, my friend, they had a great time. I lived there for 1 year.
Okay, just 1 year. Okay.
Or a year and a half.
Seventh grade.
Exactly. A year and a half. It was one football season. It was about a year and a half. And, it was, I loved San Diego. I'm still really close friends, but it's as crazy as it sounds, I'm really good friends with so many of those kids that I went to school with because we've stayed in contact. It was a little bit of culture. I think the real culture shock, to be totally honest with you, Kyle, was not DC to San Diego. It was San Diego to Texas. That was crazy. Because what I didn't tell you, my dad took 1 year off from football. He got out of football completely. He got frustrated being a defensive coordinator. He wanted to be a head coach. He didn't get any head coaching offers. So he literally left football and got into the oil business and went to work for a friend, that actually was a senator in New Mexico. And we lived in Midland, Texas, which is in the corner of the panhandle of Texas.
Yeah.
Right. And so we lived in Midland and it's an oil town. Like that's it. It's oil and there's nothing. It's flat as a pancake. There's no tree. There's very little trees. It's like West Texas, man. There's nothing out there. And I went from living in paradise in, La Jolla to living in Midland, Texas. And, but I had a great time there too. They were wearing boots and Wranglers and I'm used to wearing OP shorts and flip flops. Right. I mean, it was a
sunshine.
Exactly. Sunshine. Big time, big time culture change, but it was great. And we were there just 1 year before the Gamblers called and we moved from there over to Houston. And, Houston's really been my home most of my life. We moved back out to California during the internet boom and I'm in the software business. So I've been in tech business now for 32 years, but we lived up in the Northeast for a few years too, but we came back to Texas in like 2002.
Let's talk about your dad's time with the Cougars. Obviously a lot of success of prolific numbers on offense. He had a pretty good quarterback named Andre Ware. First black man to win the Heisman Trophy.
Incredible.
Talk about your memories of. No, I'm confused. Andre was not the first black player.
Yes, he was.
He was. Okay.
He was the first African American quarterback to win the
quarterback. Heisman. Yeah.
Quarterback. Yeah, because I remember OJ won it.
He was the first quarterback.
Yeah, I was sitting there reading my notes and I had that wrong. I just had it in my notes wrong.
Oh, you're right.
I was thinking, guessing myself. Quarterback. Okay. All right.
QB. And let me tell you, those are my people. My old teammates, we're still close. We see each other every weekend during football season. I just saw Dre last week. We are all super close. Those are my running buddies. I mean, we built a bond in college that was so tight. And, those guys, I love those guys. We took a team that, they were struggling. They were 1-9 in 1986, in 86, fall of 86, which was my senior year in high school. And, they went from, 1-9 or 1-10, to we were 10-1 and the number one offense in the nation, setting and breaking all kinds of records. Just an unbelievable life experience playing for my dad for 3 of the 4 years that I was in school, built a great working relationship with my dad. It's when you're in college and you want to be a goof. Like I was a complete goof in college. I couldn't be, the boss was my dad. I had to, you know, so it was a different deal, but we had a great time. The best part is when you're beating everybody up and you're having a good time doing it. And you're doing it with guys that other teams were like, yeah, that guy's not any good. That guy's not, you know, Andre Ware. Andre was recruited by Texas. But Texas said, no, you'll never play quarterback here. You'll play defensive back for us. So Andre made sure that the first time we played them, we put 70 or we beat them 66 to 24 or something like that. Or sorry, 66 to 40. And then we put 60 on them 3 years in a row.
Wow. Speaking of big numbers, obviously, yeah. very famous game. What do you remember about the SMU game? 1,021 yards of total offense. The Cougs scored 95 points, 95 to 21. Obviously, Houston or SMU coming off the death penalty. But what do you remember about that game? And was that necessary?
Well, there's layers. I mean, so first off, football is a big family, and families, you know, good and bad, right?
Yeah.
But your family. Forrest Gregg was the head coach at SMU, and Forrest Gregg and my dad were tight friends. Like Forrest, he was with Green Bay. So when the USFL folded, my dad was unemployed for 9 months. And so my dad became a scout for the Green Bay Packers. Why? Because his friend Forrest Gregg got him the job. So Forrest and my dad have been through things in their lives before. Forrest, there's actually a picture of me, my dad and Forrest Gregg shaking at the end of the game and having a conversation. My dad said basically, sorry, it got out of hand, Forrest. And Forrest said to him, don't worry about it, Jack, it's football. So then the SMU, I got to meet some of SMU's coaches later in my career. And they told me, they said that when the team got on the buses, one of the assistant coaches started cussing the Houston Cougar staff. And Forrest got up and said, let me tell you something. They treated us with respect. They didn't back down. They played us as hard as they could. And by the way, that was their third and fourth string that was out there whipping our guys' ass at the end of the game. Excuse my language. He goes, that's how you want to be treated. Later that year, I don't know if you remember, but like I think they played Notre Dame, and Notre Dame had, you know, wide open runs, and they'd be running down the field, and then they'd run out of bounds. That's disrespectful to your opponent.
Yeah.
And so me, Kyle, I want your best. I want your best.
Oh, yeah.
And if it means that you're going to roll up 95 on me and I can't stop you, I can't stop your third string quarterback or your walk-on. We played a quarterback named Tim McCauley. He was in the top 10 all-time freshman passers at U of H as a walk-on because of that year. Now, his records have been blown away, but since, you know, with Case Keenum and all these other guys that came in. But, you know, I'm not talking about, like, we didn't leave the starters in. Andre was pulled at the half, and then this young guy, David Klingler, you may know that name as well.
Yep.
He wanted to get his. So he went out there, and I mean, you guys know football. They played bump and run. They tried to play cover one against Houston. They should have backed into cover four, exactly. And they didn't. And so the run and shoot had auto check back then. If they're going to roll your corners and get in your face, it's all go.
Yeah, so, we had this conversation the other night, the guys and I, and I'm agreeing with you 100%. I just in terms of football philosophy. You put your backups in, they need to run your offense or they're not going to learn it. They're going to be useless if you just, you know, use them handing the ball off. You got to run your offense. So, no, yeah. I was kidding when I said was that necessary, but it was.
it was a little, and we took a lot of heat for it in the press, and that was sort of the beginning of sort of this, you know, the media decided to paint us as the villains, and I think it hurt David Klingler more than any person, because David Klingler was one of the great, you go look at his numbers. He was one of the greatest quarterbacks that ever played college football. He was patient. He waited 4 years to play. He waited. Who would do that today? Nobody. I don't know anybody that would do that. David Klingler was patient. He waited. And when he got his shot, he was light. He was electric. And he beat a lot. He broke a lot of Andre's records. And his senior year, he was the number one quarterback by a mile in college football in 1991. And season of 1990, we were 10-1. That was my senior year, 10-1. and ranked third, as high as third in the nation at one point. We finished at 10, and they didn't name him All-American.
Oh, wow.
So you know what that means. He can never be admitted to the College Football Hall of Fame. You must be named All-American in order to get into the College Football Hall of Fame.
And that's the rule that needs to change.
Listen to these stats.
I totally agree with you. It's got to be changed because the press was just bitter, or just they're the same way today, quite frankly, a lot of this stuff. But, you know, they wanted to take it out on somebody. Oh, Houston running up the score on all these people. Because, I mean, we put 82 on Tulsa. We killed Rice every time we played them. We beat everybody back then.
He put over 5,000 yards and 54 touchdowns his junior year.
Yeah.
That was my
senior year. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Like, the guy was unbelievable. So it's too bad. But,
and his senior year, he had mediocre numbers, which would be 3,300, almost 3,400 yards, 29 touchdowns, but not mediocre, but I'm just
four wins that year or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
He was only off by 2,000 from his junior year. But I mean, yeah, come on, guys. You can't hold out against a kid in college doing his job. That's insane.
Exactly. Your dad moves on to the NFL again after that. Goes across town to the Oilers. talk about his run there. He has some success.
Yeah.
Apparently, loves staying in Houston.
Well, yeah. My dad has said, "Look, you know, he's the luckiest guy. He would always say, 'I'm the luckiest man on the planet. I got to coach three teams in one town.' Like that never happens. And so he coached the Gamblers, he coached the Cougars, and he coached the Oilers. And man, so close. You know, I think finally the monkey is off of their back, off of our back on that Buffalo thing thank you to the Colts for allowing Minnesota to come back and break that record last year. That 1993 season was so close and so it's like one of those things. They need to make a 30 for 30 on it or something, man. Commits suicide. You go on a 10 game win streak. You're just mauling everybody in the playoffs. You're killing the Bills in the first half of the game, and then their backup quarterback Frank Reich comes out of nowhere and wins the game. Like, it just was crazy.
What do you remember your dad saying after that game? I mean, I'm sure it was a shock, but I mean, what was his reaction after that game?
Well, this is kind of where, you know, I think there's the fan perception of what football is and what they think should happen, and then there's the reality. So the first thing that happened was ownership and general manager, they got involved. Like, they stepped in and said, "We're going to make some changes." And they made, you know, they forced my dad to fire two awesome coaches, Jim Eddy, who had been my defensive coordinator at Houston. He went on to the Cowboys and had a long career in the NFL. Jim Eddy and Pat Thomas. And Pat was a great Texas A&M cornerback, played for the Rams for probably 12
years. I remember, yeah.
PT, Pat Thomas. Two of the greatest people on the planet. And they were the guys that took the fall. They took the blame. And, you know, that was hard for my dad to do that. And then they said, "Okay, we're bringing in our guy." And our guy was Buddy Ryan.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody thinks the head coach has all this leeway and can do whatever he wants. And you know what? Even Jack Pardee, who was College Football Hall of Fame, you know, respected legend that played the game for 16 years, coaching for, you know, all these great players, even he got told what to do by ownership. And that was unfortunate. It really was. My dad has known Buddy for years. They come from the same coaching tree, which is the old Chicago Bears, the Bear defense. So the Bear that a lot of teams or people will talk about was invented by George Halas, obviously. And then George Halas had a defensive coordinator named George Allen, who took the Bear defense and then, you know, put his fingerprint on it. And then that's the defense my dad ran his whole career, and that's the defense that I played under. We still see it today all over the place. A lot of the four-man fronts that you see are they originate from the Chicago Bears. And so Buddy had his flavor of it that he called the 46. Right. And it was actually – people – he didn't invent the 46 defense. He took a sub-defense, as it's called, right? So you've got your main defense, and then you would have subsets, right? So you have nickel, for instance, is a sub, mm-hmm. right? Or dime is a sub, right? So the 46 was just, hey, you change the front responsibilities, and you put a strong safety on the line of scrimmage as either a rush end, which is now why we have this rush end term, or and strong safeties back when I was playing football, they were 6'5". The strong safety was big, like a linebacker. That's why these rush ends are all 6'5" now, right? Not 5'10". Free safeties were never 5'10". You can maybe a cornerback, but you know, think about guys like Steve Atwater. I played against Steve Atwater. He was at Arkansas. I played against. There was a bunch of other guys that were just big, giant guys that played safety. But anyway, that was what it was. So, you know, Buddy came in, played a high pressure defense. Played the 46 primarily, and you know, he did fine. But what he did to, you know, the term culture is a little overused today, but what he did to the culture of the team was really bad. And you know, like he would do things that were not team like and as an example, if he got embarrassed, if like one of his play, like very competitive in practice, very competitive, very like over the top competitive with the offensive coaches, to the extent that the offensive coaches and the defensive coaches had to have separate locker rooms at the Oilers facility.
Wow.
Because there's so much hatred between the two. And my dad could not have a single staff meeting. He had to have separate offensive meeting and defensive.
Oh, wow.
Meeting. And Buddy would do things like if he got embarrassed, one of his guys got beat, he'd just pull everybody in the defense off the field and say, okay, we're done with practice and go in. And he did it multiple times. And so, you know, again, this is the inside baseball that a lot of people don't tell you about, but you know, those owners, they might be really good businessmen, but they're not really good at putting people together that need to be on the same page to be successful. And the only way all the best teams that I was with, everybody was pointing in the same direction. Everybody was, we had one leader. We had one leader on offense, Andre Ware. We had, you know, our offensive coordinator, John Jenkins. We had Jack Pardee was our head coach and Jim Eddy was our defensive coordinator. And they were the men, they were the dudes. They respected each other. Were we competitive in practice at Houston? Or heck yeah. Like I didn't want Andre Ware to complete a pass in those practices, but we were still teammates. We had to work together. So everybody wonders why were the Oilers so divisive back in those days? Well, it was hard for the head coach to manage the team the way that it needed to be managed because his authority had been undermined by the owner.
That's unbelievable.
And it gets so bad, you know, everybody remembers the incident on the sideline where Buddy punches Kevin Gilbride on the sidelines. And, you know, just like you said, it's good, you know. It's almost like the owners wanted to get the flashy name in there, the Buddy Ryan name in there, but you didn't think about the chemistry that how you mess with the chemistry on that team then. Because you look at the Oilers, you know, the House of Pain. They had a good thing going, but just because you get the flashy name in there doesn't mean you're going to be any better. And
it just blows my mind that. You know, they had so much talent on that team. That team Definitely. Was so good defensively and offensively. Like blows your mind when you go back and watch them play. But the reality was that the leadership was, they were so focused on the bottom line that they couldn't think big picture. And sometimes what I appreciate about the NFL today is I think that there's some owners that are good businessmen and they do think big picture. They do think about, okay, hey, we need to give this coach time, or we need to not undermine this guy's authority. We need to do it the right way. Those types of things. But there are still some kooky teams out there. Let me tell you, some kooky owners. But, you know, every time I look at that talent on that team, I just feel like, could you imagine if Buddy had just played along? Like, hey, man, just you know what? I know you think you know more than Jack Pardee does about football, but you know what? Work with him. You know, work with Kevin Gilbride. You don't have to like him. I mean, we don't like everybody that we work with or go to school with or whatever. But you know what? You got to do it for the team.
Yeah, and I'm a Steelers fan. I'm well aware of the talent that was on those Houston Oilers teams back then. They were scary.
Yeah, exactly. The team that came in, man. And then what did the owner do? He ended up trading Warren Moon.
The
greatest quarterback ever. Like, or well, that, for the Oilers at least.
Wasn't that after the owner made a threat if they didn't make the Super Bowl, he was going to have a fire sale? Was that Bud Adams?
Yep.
Yeah. Bud Adams.
Yeah, they still own the Titans. Their family still owns the Titans.
Well, I wanted to get to a couple things here as we wrap it up real fast. I wanted to ask you more. You've talked about it quite a bit, but just playing for your dad, as you mentioned, you know, playing against Andre Ware in practice, et cetera, et cetera. Was your dad extra hard on you, or did he just treat you like one of the boys?
No, I mean, he said, look, I can't give you anything. You're going to have to make it so obvious to everybody on the field. Every player is going to have to be convinced that you deserve to be out there. And so that put it on to me. And, you know, that was totally fair with me. You know, I feel like it was tough, but it was what I needed to do to earn the respect of my teammates. And that's the thing that I appreciate the most, because today I can, you know, walk around the University of Houston, and I wasn't a superstar. I played, but, you know, not a ton. And I was a backup on defense, and I played special teams mostly. And I was the deep snapper. I did that, too, back in those days.
And go ahead.
What's that?
Go ahead if you weren't finished with your thought.
Yeah, no, and I was just going to say, you know, to me, he treated me the way it needed to be treated. You cannot show favoritism to your son in any situation like that. They have to earn it themselves. So then when I was, you know, I have two sons, and I've coached them both growing up. And I didn't give anything to them, anything. And I made them earn it and get, you know, knocked down and make them pick themselves back up and go do it. And it's been great for them. My youngest is a quarterback at TCU, and my older son is a wide receivers coach for the Houston Roughnecks XFL team. Works for Wade Phillips.
Wow. And a couple other things I wanted to bring up here. One tidbit I found here online that I found interesting. Your dad tried to get the Houston Cougar job again. Was that when they hired Art Briles? When was that? It was sometime in 2000.
It was after Art left. It was they ended up hiring Kevin Sumlin.
Yeah, Sumlin. Okay.
Yeah, they hired Kevin Sumlin, and he was, you know, 72 years old or something like that, and had an awesome coaching staff that he had lined up ready to go, that I would have been a part of, which would have been so exciting for me because, you know, it was a point where in my career where I could make a break, and that would have been really amazing. David Klingler was going to be on that staff as well as quarterbacks coach and co-offensive coordinator. We would have run the run and shoot with Case Keenum. You know, we were going to bring back the run and shoot, and we had a great defensive staff lined up, which got me excited. And you know, there's a couple guys that were going to be on my dad's staff that are currently coaching right now. Kenny Perry, who's a coach at Texas Tech right now. He would have been on that staff. So it was like a, you know, it would have been a cool little thing that would have happened. And I know that with the talent that played against, you know, we played some big time games against ECU back in those days. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know,
oh yeah.
You know, those were some battles, and it would have been fun. They ended up running the air raid, and Dana Holgorsen came in as the OC, and the rest is history. But it would have been cool. It would have been a great experience.
Your dad, that's interesting to think about. I mean, obviously the Kevin Sumlin thing worked, but it sounds like your dad was prepared, would have had a good staff, would have been successful again. Your dad got sick with cancer, passed away in 2013. How did you, you know, I dealt with cancer. I had colon cancer, you know, going for screenings constantly live with the fear. Your dad sounds like he found out pretty late stage that he was sick.
So that was the third time he had cancer.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah, you all have the battle.
You'll have to check it out online. But when he was 27 years old, or 27, he was diagnosed with melanoma when he was playing for the Rams. And this is before I was born. So he was out of football for a year. So he missed weight. So technically he played 15 years. He didn't play 16. He played 15 because he had a gap of 1 year. And so my mom was reading the LA Times and was reading a story about this pitcher from the Houston Astros who had just died of melanoma, and Ted Umbricht. And it was weird because he wore number 32, and that was the same number my dad wore.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, she was reading the article, and he had a brown mole on his arm, like up on his shoulder there, close to his shoulder, a brown mole. And they didn't catch it soon enough, and he passed away. And his jersey hangs in Minute Maid Park. He was a great pitcher for the Astros. And this is in, you know, 1966, somewhere in there, 65. And so my mom was like, Jack, you've got that black mole on your arm. You know, we really should go get that checked out. And sure enough, you know, that saved my dad's life. He had experimental surgery at UCLA that hasn't changed much. They still, I had melanoma 2 years ago, and my daughter had, my daughter's 30 and she had melanoma this year. God bless her. She's doing fine. But you know, the key here, Kyle, is you got to get checked up. You got to check frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Catch it quick enough, they can take care of it. It's when you don't get checked up and it goes on and on and on and on that there's a problem. So he ended up, he had gallbladder cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it had spread throughout his stomach and everything else. So, you know, it's the big C is a bad thing, man, but it touches some unbelievable, like one in two people, something like that. So, you know,
it's crazy. It's out of control. That's a whole, boy, I could go on and on about thoughts of that, dealing with it with myself and, you know, the voice of the Pirates, Jeff Charles,
yep.
You know, his battle with it. And, you know, yep. Unfortunately we lost Jeff to a heart attack, but
I know.
It's just there's, I won't even, we could do a whole show,
a on whole this. Show on that.
You probably got similar thoughts I do about things that they put in our food and all like that, that,
exactly. That's exactly right. You are 100%, dude. 100%. And, you know, you got to go fight just to figure all that stuff out. But, yeah, you know, and but yes, you know, it touched our family. You know, when I got melanoma, my mom, you know, freaked out. My siblings were all freaked out because it was like, for back in the 60s, it was a death penalty, you know.
And yeah.
My dad was lucky to beat it. I luckily have a great doctors and, you know, we got it done and my daughter got it done this year too, but you just got to go get checked up.
That's yeah. My wife's grandmother, also had melanoma in the '60s and, thankfully, you know, it was Duke for her.
Yeah.
UCLA for your dad. I mean, back then, if you weren't near a research institute, you were pretty much doomed.
You were in big trouble. Exactly. So. Exactly.
Well, Stevie, did you have anything else that you wanted to ask Ted about his father?
No, just an honor to be able to talk to you. You know, like I said, off the air, my parents are diehard Redskin fans. And that, like I said, when I was old enough to know what football was, that was, you know, his name and Chris Hamburger's name were the first two names I remember. And just an honor to be able to talk to you tonight.
Oh, no, you're too kind. And great days in Washington, you know, great memories and great experiences. We love the Redskins and just the whole experience was awesome. But appreciate you guys letting me come on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ted, for being with us. And we will see you down the road. And good luck to the Cougars in the Big 12 this year.
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Waiting on. All right. There we go. Hey, there we go. So we got the Coach's Kid is an archive, guys. If you enjoyed this show live, go on our YouTube channel, anywhere you listen to podcasts, listen to previous episodes. Episode 1 was with Tommy Bowden, obviously former head coach of Clemson and Tulane. We talked to him about his father, Bobby Bowden, amongst his own career. And then the other episode that we have out, which I mentioned earlier, it was with Kate Holland-Baynard, as she talked about her dad, legendary UVA head coach and former East Carolina athletic director, Terry Holland. And that's a personal favorite of mine. I love Terry so much.
Yeah.
And so go check that one out. List all of them. All of these episodes have been good, including tonight's episode. But just for my personal note, that one right there is of all the podcasts we've done, and that's covering everything. That interview with Kate Holland is one of my favorites of all time. I really enjoyed that interview because it's really nice to solidify what you thought of a man, what you saw of a man, knowing him, you know, but not personally, knowing him on a surface level. The man you thought he was is exactly what he was. So go check that one out if you haven't yet. And wait for that to get off screen, and I'll wrap it up.
Hello, Bubba.
There we go. All right.
There we go.
All right. So, so Steve, there's Bubba right there. Bubba's popping in, making a cameo here at the end.
Yeah.
But
didn't think Ted was gonna sign out before the show was over. So yeah, I was trying to fix the overlay so nobody had the logo on their face.
That's you know, the old logo. You don't want the old logo on your face. Yeah. So we gonna promote upcoming content, I guess, real fast before we get out of here. Tomorrow night we have the Pirate Preview, and me, Matt, Dave tomorrow night, Bubba? What's the story with that?
We will have either Adam Witten of the App State Network, obviously their play-by-play guy, or one of the guys, probably perhaps Big C from the Black and Gold podcast.
Okay, so you go tune into that tomorrow night, the Pirate Preview, as we preview East Carolina Appalachian State. Me and Steve, we will be back with you Wednesday night about 8 o'clock, as we will have Terry Gallagher on with us as we talk about his record-setting performance against Appalachian State. We will have a top five of some kind. Steve, you'll be thinking about that. We got to have a top five.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
And also, Wednesday night, don't forget, before just another sports podcast with me and Stevie, you got Sonny and Semenza, former East Carolina tight end, Jay Sudhalter, former East Carolina linebacker, Matt Semenza, will be previewing this week in college football and giving their picks for week three of the college football season. So tune into that Wednesday night before just another sports podcast. And then on Thursday night, we have Jesus Christ, I can't think of the name of the show. I'm horrible at this.
The Inside Slant.
The Inside Slant. Thank you. That's where we take a wide, broad spectrum at all, a big look at all the big world of college football. And we'll be looking at week three games. We'll have guests on from throughout the country previewing the big games of the week for week three. I just can't remember the name of the damn show. But yeah, it is the Inside Slant. So,
interesting note, guys. I don't know if you guys are paying attention to Monday Night Football, but Aaron Rodgers lasted one series and got hurt. Not yet known how severe the injury is. He got sacked. Didn't look anything bad. He went down pretty easy, but he was escorted off the field and hadn't been back then. So Zach Wilson steps in for Aaron Rodgers. So should be interesting to see what kind of injury this is.
Yeah, big story in the NFL, obviously, Aaron Rodgers getting injured. Huge news. So hopefully nothing too severe.
Yeah, it wouldn't be good for the Jets, that's for sure.
No, definitely not. So, all right, Stevie, Bubba, and for Ted Pardee, I am Kyle Barber, and you have been listening to The Coach's Kid here on the Sports Objective Podcasting Network. Good night, everybody, and go Pirates.
See ya.